I'm in the studio, as always, with my ex-student, Will Rose. Will, how are you doing?
Always a pleasure to be here.
And we are welcoming, as I said, Carlos Espinosa. Carlos, thanks for joining us in the Poets Cove. Oh, I forgot to mention, in the Poets Cove, we also have, in parentheses at the end of it, the letter N raised as if it were, to the power of, so that for some people it might be the Poets Coven, you know, where we get together and talk like witches. For others, it's a cove where we just sit in a protected place and talk about things that concern poets. But thank you for being on the Poets Cove.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. Also, a next student of yours.
That's right. Yeah, you know, I forgot all about that.
Yeah.
That's right. You got your MFA at the University of Texas, El Paso, and you took me for a fiction writing class.
Yeah, a couple of fiction writing classes and some Chicano literature courses.
Yeah, well, thanks for being on the show. And can you read his bio? You got his bio, Will?
Yeah, I have it up. So Carlos lives and writes along the U.S.-Mexico border. You can read his work in Spry Literary Magazine, Border Senses, Pilgrimage, The Rift, and Chrysalis. Did I say that right? While earning his bilingual MFA at the University of Texas at El Paso, Carlos contributed to the editing of Andres Montoya's posthumous collection of poetry, A Jury of Trees. In addition, Carlos is the editor-in-chief of the Barrio Panther Lectura magazine.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, thank you. It sounds crazy when other people are listing off things and you're like, oh man, that's just my life. You know? But
Borges had a moment like that. He has a story where he's talking about, it's called El Otro Yo, where he's reading, you know, these things about Borges, and it doesn't sound like him, but he knows it is him because Borges, the writer, the one who's famous for writing about infinity and mirrors and all that stuff, stole it all from him.
Yeah. That's definitely how I feel when I look at all the stuff that I've been fortunate enough to be part of in literature, you know?
Right. I should probably disclose that Carlos is also my brother-in-law.
Yes. Yeah, definitely.
And but that didn't happen until years after you were a graduate student with us.
Yeah. As speaking of poetry, you and my sister met at a poetry reading that I was part of.
That's right. And we all went to the tap afterwards and had nachos and beer.
Yep.
And now you're my cuñado.
And now we're family.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not sure how you feel about that, but I feel okay.
I feel great about it.
I'm all right with it.
Yeah. And, beautiful little niece that adds to the Espinosa Chacon legacy, you know?
Well, you know, it's interesting because, you know, before I met your sister, I didn't have family in El Paso. I mean, I do have some third cousins that live on the east side that I've met, you know, and interacted with, but I didn't have, you know, close family. So all my holidays, I would leave. I'd go to different countries or I'd, you know, go here or there. But now all my holidays, I have to, not have to, I get to do stuff with all the families you guys have
here
in El Paso. And you have a lot of family here.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a good thing. Yeah. That's an interesting, you know, interesting shift. Mm. Not have to, but get to, you know, I like that. That's beautiful.
Yeah. So Carlos and I were talking a little while ago about the migrants that have been coming to El Paso. I don't know if you've heard about this in the news, but can you explain a little bit what's happening on the border?
Yeah, there was a influx of migrants coming in from Venezuela. And there was a Title 42, which prevented people from coming across and seeking asylum. They had to wait in Mexico and apply. But Title 42 is coming to an end. And so the people who were there waiting, plus the new influx of migrants, were, you know, straining the Border Patrol system.
Mm-hmm.
And so what the Border Patrol was doing was that they were going and dropping off 1,000 people in the middle of you know, downtown and not really informing. Downtown El Paso, yeah, by the Greyhound bus.
Yeah, so how many thousands came into downtown El Paso?
Oh, I would probably say 40,000 maybe.
Wow.
Over that span of 3-4
months. And you worked downtown, so you interacted with this landscape every day.
Yeah. You know, I got to see it. I got to see facilities. I also went down to Brownsville and McAllen, Texas, and toured their facilities and kind of saw what they were doing with their migrant situation. They were sending them to us. That's what they were doing. But yeah, suddenly we were swamped with a lot of people. And the beautiful thing is that, you know, the communities of El Paso responded. They went out there and helped. They took food and clothing and really helping people get on their way where they needed to go. The people who were coming, most of them had family throughout the country. So really El Paso was like their stopping point, their first entry into the United States. And I'd like to think that we treated them with grace and the people really responded, the community responded.
Yeah, that's a beautiful thing about El Paso. You know, that wouldn't have happened in a lot of other cities. You know, a friend of mine gathered together money and got, I forget how much he got, but he went and bought a whole bunch of coats because these families were sleeping outside in the middle of winter and it was getting down to 20 degrees every night. And he bought them coats. And one of the sad images that he left with me was how when they arrived, there were so many people that wanted coats that it was kind of, you know, heartbreaking. And they had to turn people away when they had to say there's no more.
Yeah. I mean, I had this friend who said one of the saddest things was he made food. He made a bunch of burritos and he was handing them out. And he said one of the saddest things is seeing people in line and then running out of the burritos, running out of the food. And then they just like have to turn away. And, you know, he said that really broke his heart. And,
you know, both those images, I really kind of say the same thing that as much as El Paso, you know, people are trying to help, there's just not enough. The influx is just way too, the numbers are way too huge. It's at 40,000. You can imagine downtown El Paso, if you've ever been to downtown El Paso, you know, 40,000 people living in the streets, some of them living in shelters. I think they were only able to house a certain fraction of them to put them in areas where they can actually have beds or sleep on floors. Everyone else had to sleep outside.
I mean, it's important to note that the 40,000 weren't there all at once, right? Mm-hmm. What they were doing is dropping off like 800 to 1,000 people a day.
Wow.
So you're talking about over you know, the 3-month period. So fortunately, you know, there was programs to get migrants, you know, on buses and get them to the cities that they needed to go. And so I think everything went pretty smooth in terms of like they were here. Most people were staying here 24, 48 hours the most. And then they were going to their destination cities, wherever they were, their family was. So I think that helped a lot. So we didn't just have like, you know, and then of course, all these Annunciation House, all these wonderful charities kicking in and helping out.
Right. Yeah, but that's a beautiful thing, yeah. Taking care of the people. You know, that's certainly more biblical and more Christian than a lot of the reactions coming from more, conservative perspective, you know.
Yeah, that's one.
You know, I mean, it's always really struck me that Christians, a lot of Christians who read the Bible every day, you know, and who profess their Christianity, they wear it, you know, they wear their Christianity, would want to treat them so poorly and wouldn't want to help them out at all, you know, when it's clearly stated, not only in the Old Testament, but in the New Testament, to welcome the foreigner.
Yeah.
You know, give them clothes, give them, you know, welcome the hungry. And,
yeah.
You know, can you imagine Jesus, you know, getting, hanging out with the Minutemen, shooting at, you know, at brown people?
And, you know, that's like Abbott, his portion of helping El Paso was to send troops, build a mile of concertina barbed wire fence and just stand there. And I'm like, that didn't help us at all. You know, that didn't help anybody.
Yeah.
So, you know, to that point of Christian conservatives not having that empathy, sympathy.
Right. But El Paso did. And it's definitely changed a lot of the dynamics and the energy that is circulating throughout our city. But we were talking about that to get back to the idea of the Poets Cove. You know, we're poets. And so we filter in many ways everything that happens in the world through our, you know, aesthetic and conscious lens, right? I mean, we have the eyes of poets. We can't help it, you know?
Yeah.
And So you and I were talking about this, and you were bringing up what should the poet do about this? What should the writer do about this? Do we write about it? And yeah, we should write about it. But at what point does writing about it sensationalize ourselves as writers? I guess that's for some writers, it could be a challenge. You want to write about it, but you don't want to write about it in a way that's exploitative.
That's not exploitative. I was thinking about this after we talked about it, is maybe that's part of what drives us as writers also, thinking that we're going to produce something, we're going to create something so beautiful that it changes Earth, it changes the way humans look at things. And maybe that's why we become empathetic and we're drawn to these stories of loss, because they change us fundamentally when we do experience it.
Yeah, and really, you know, stories, whether they're written by people who come from the oppressed or, you know, people who come from, you know, the privileged, you know, there definitely needs to be something oppressing the characters, you know, that some conflict that they have to overcome. There's also the being a brown person, you know, being Latinx, you know, when I was involved in the Chicano movement, when I was an undergraduate at Fresno State, one of the first things that you learn right away is that you are an oppressed people. You come from an oppressed people, and it is your responsibility to speak out against it.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's kind of where maybe that sort of, even in the Chicano movement, that exploitation can happen, where someone, you know, they get a lot of notoriety because they're not just telling someone's story, but they're also claiming to champion them. And, you know, and they live in a completely different part of the city, or they live in a completely different part of, in a different reality, a different world. And they just kind of come in as tourists and dip in. And then as soon as they get what they want, you know, they leave, right? Unfortunately, you know, we see that a lot in El Paso and Juarez. You know, there's documentary filmmakers that'll go and take advantage of the violence in Juarez and not really care about the people, but just wanting to get that story that they can exploit. You know, I remember one time Vice came down here and we were trying to tell them, well, focus on all the art and the culture that's happening. And they promised they would. And when the video comes out, it's all about the, you know, the drug wars, you know what I mean?
You are listening to A Conversation in the Writer's Cove. If you want to hear the extended version of this, you can go to wordsonawire.org or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Now let's get back to the conversation. You know, when the shootings at Walmart happened, and when the migrant thing happens, a lot of times media reaches out to writers, you know, local writers. And I was contacted by somebody, I think from the New York Times, about the possibility of writing a column. And I thought about, wow, New York Times. And I almost dropped everything to, you know, respond to him and, you know, say, yeah, I'd be really New York Times. Yeah, I'd like to do a column in the New York Times. But then I realized that my motivation, when my first reaction wasn't, oh yeah, we need to say something about this. It was about being in the New York Times. And so I thought, there's got to be a better way for me to speak out than to, you know, seek, you know, and I think, you know, and I don't judge myself for feeling that way, because I think that's also a human instinct that we want to, you know, be recognized. And I know, for example, and this may sound like a stretch and I hope I don't offend anybody, but there's sometimes people who crave social media attention so much that when a parent dies and they post and they get multiple hits and comments, it becomes almost addictive. And then they continue to post, you know, hoping that this is not going to be something that is going to go away, but that it's upping their reach on social media. Does that sound crazy?
That sounds like hell. You know what I mean? Like, that's what hell would sound like. Like, you pining for these people's attention over and over and over, and you're using tragedy to do it, and you have to kind of maybe disconnect a little bit of your human to the actual experience, because you want.
But can you imagine that happening?
Oh, I see it all the time. Of course.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's what I'm saying. Yeah.
That's hell.
And it is hell. But a lot of times we choose hell. You have a probably one of the most interesting jobs I've ever heard. You know, we're all writers here, and you know, by writers I mean poets. You know, creative writers. Will got his bachelor's degree in creative writing. He's my ex-student. He was in my intro class. And were you in a fiction class too?
Yeah, I think it was fiction.
And then you were in a graduate fiction seminar and a Chicano literature seminar when you were in grad school.
Yeah, two fiction workshops.
Yeah,
in the Chicano literature.
And so, yeah. And so one of the things that writers need to do is make a living. Not everybody, that old model of writers getting an MFA and then getting a tenure track position on the East Coast and, you know, you know, writing bourgeois novels and stories for the rest of their lives is definitely an outdated model. It's as outdated as the metaphor of Schwab's drugstore, you know, where the 16-year-old girl is sitting in the drugstore and they say, you know, she's sucking on a soda and a movie producer sees her and says, baby, you're going to be a star. And he makes her into a star. You know, the idea of being discovered is a myth among writers. It just doesn't exist. But also the idea of the tenure track job, you know, and the tweed coat and signing books and kissing babies at a bookstore in Union Square in New York. It's all, you know, it's all just a bunch of crap. You'd be surprised that a lot of writers get into it for that reason. They want that life. You know,
yeah, me included. I tried.
Yeah. Okay. So probably most writers, you know, but at a certain point you begin to realize. And so one of the things that you need to realize is if you get an MFA, it doesn't mean you're going to, you know, that's going to be the life. You're going to have to work your butt off. And I know Will worked his butt off and became, you know, a CTO of an AI company, which he is right now. And
cool.
You worked your butt off and you are one of the hardest working writers I've ever met. And you just landed probably one of the most interesting gigs a writer could land. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, definitely. So I'm a city storyteller and it was an interesting buildup. 10 years of, working at colleges, trying to get that tenure position, that life that you're talking about, that dream, 10 years of that. And then I was done with it and I decided, okay, I'm just going to freelance, right? And I wrote these books for people in India and Malaysia, and I was writing all kinds of different things. And
what do you mean you wrote books for people in India and Asia?
Yeah.
So that's interesting in itself. Yeah. I have no idea what that means.
I was contracted to write a book for the president of the Sleep Apnea Association in Malaysia.
No way.
And so it was a book on sleep, right? And sleep apnea and sleep in COVID and sleep in your health. And I said, okay, I can write it. First I sold him a chapter and then he liked the chapter and okay, we're going to do it 5 chapters at a time. And then after I sold him the whole book, after he had liked it, you know, I did research. He sent me research. Then I told him, you know, I can do book layouts. So then he paid me to do the book layout and then to do the book cover and then to do the website and then to do.
So does the book have your name on it?
No, it's ghostwritten, right?
So it has his name.
It has his name. Wow. And then he sent me a picture not too long ago and it's the prime minister or president of Malaysia holding the book that
no
I wrote,
way.
You know? And I'm like, wow, man,
that's
I
awesome.
Get more notoriety writing as other someone else, you know?
How did you do that? How did you manage to get that job?
Through freelance, you know, freelance websites where you find people looking for writers or, you know, web designers, podcast producers, all kinds of stuff, right?
Is there a lot of competition with other writers or is it
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. There's thousands of people and it's, you know, these things are like globally. So you get people like in India who will do the work for a third of what you will do the work
what
for.
What did you do the work for? If you don't mind telling.
Yeah, it was a couple thousand dollars to write the book and then another couple thousand to design the website and do the layout and stuff.
So you were like one of the most resourceful writers I know because one of the things that you seemed committed to was that you were going to make a living off your writing. So you did that and what else? Because we want to lead to the job you have now, which is storyteller. I can't believe that.
You know, I'm writing commercials for beer companies in Minnesota and just all kinds of crazy things, right? And I'm also playing music, but at the same time, I get this beautiful in with Mouthfeel Press, and Maria hires me to edit some of her poetry.
Maria Maloney, who's been on this show many times.
Yeah, yeah.
We love Maria Maloney and Mouthfeel Press.
Yeah, so then she hired me. Then I got hired at Row House Publishing to do a sensitivity reading on a book that came out. They wanted to make sure that it passed the, it got the brown thumbs up, you know.
And this was, all this was enough to keep you going.
It was enough to keep me just afloat, just fucking afloat, you know what I mean? Right. Like sometimes I had to use a straw to keep me up, but it was just enough to keep me afloat. My amazing wife and my children who were all patient. Also, since I was at home with my children. So
nice.
You know, I couldn't be happier. Right. You know what I mean? And
right.
I'm teaching them stuff and we're hanging out every day. And like now that, you know, I'm at the 9 to 5, I miss them tremendously, you know?
Right, but, right. Well, you're a great father.
Yeah, thank you.
I really admire the interaction you have with your daughters. I observe all the time and it's like, wow.
Awesome. Thank
good
you.
Good role model for me because I'm a new daddy.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. That's, you know, and then I come across this job, my friend who's, he's a drummer in my band. He sends me, he's like, hey, I got this link, dude. I'm going to send it to you. And I look at it and it's a city storyteller. And I'm like, you know, pays nice, pays more than, being a professor was paying. And I'm like, this is very cool, you know?
Wow.
And I apply.
City storyteller. Yeah. That's interesting. Is it like a poet laureate position or what is it to be the city storyteller?
That's what I thought, that I would just be writing about how great the city is, which uh-huh. I do that. But also there's, you know, the way a city is run is sort of like a, you know, it's in terms of business and data and you know, everything has to be done in terms of data. So you could see, well, this park has the most visitors, so therefore we need to start investing into that park. Or, you know what I mean? It's driven by data. And really my job is to sort of interpret that into, you know, what it's showing to the community. Like the community.
Oh, that's interesting. So you take the raw data and
yes.
and you create a story.
And I create a narrative behind it. Yes, exactly.
That's interesting. Because, yeah. you know, that's what physicists that attempt to explain, complex ideas have to give us a story so that we understand who we are and where our place is in the universe. And you're doing that on the level of the city, right?
Yes. Yeah, exactly.
You're like saying, this is who we are. This is El Paso and this is our story. And you are writing it.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Because I think a lot of, you know, it doesn't translate. Like you go downtown and downtown's so beautiful. I've never seen it this beautiful in, you know, my life, my 40 years of existence. I've never seen downtown lit up with people and populated.
And it's so pleasant on a weekend. It used to be when I first moved here, if you went there on a Saturday night, there was nobody there, but you know, a few homeless people here and there and everything was closed except for the tap.
Yeah.
But now it's like you're living in a city. There's restaurants, there's bars, there's cafes, there's children in the plaza.
Yep.
With their families, you know.
People are on scooters, all kinds of beautiful stuff is happening. And people don't see that, or they don't understand that it was the city that creates this, right? That fosters this economic growth, right. that invests in those areas. They just think like it magically happened, but
yeah.
you know, they forget who did it. And so, yeah, I craft those narratives to show people like all these beautiful things. They're ideas
but you
that
do
come
it
from
based
the people,
on the data.
But it's done based on
data. Do you
data.
Take the data yourself and say, okay, this is what I think we could say about it?
We'll brainstorm ideas like that and we'll...
A team.
We'll have a team. Yeah, there's a team of us and we...
Talk about the story, what the possibilities
are. Yeah, the possibilities. And then, you know, sometimes some of us are more interested in this story. So it's three or four of us. So some of us are more interested in this story and we'll jump over to this story. Uh-huh. And to me, of course, I gravitated towards, you know, migration and immigration.
For some reason, I went to physics, but that was just kind of, you know, I think I was way off somewhere in dum-dum land. So let me get back to the data because I find that really interesting.
Okay.
That there's all this data. It's numbers, right? And it's numbers. And it's like, you know, you feed those numbers and you create algorithms, right? You know, you make predictions about, you know, park use and, you know, and all that stuff.
Right.
But eventually all that data and those algorithms, especially the ones you want to control, have to be given a story. It has to be. So I find that just really incredibly I don't know what, you know, again, I'm not sure how to get where I want to go. Sorry, big brain just pouring out of my head, pouring stupidity out of my head. But
well, it's human.
Something about that data, about that data and what you're doing with it that just really makes it interesting, because the thing is, cities haven't always been run by data. Universities haven't always been run by data, but now they're being run by data, but data means nothing unless you can sell it as a story. So can you give us like maybe if you can give us an example of how you use data to create a story about the city or to contribute to its story?
The amount of flights that the airport has gone down,
mm-hmm.
but the amount of seats that are available for people to fly out of the airport has gone up. So I would have to explain, let's say, I think it went down by like 4,000 flights,
uh-huh.
but it jumped up by like 50,000 seats or something like that for the year. So then I have to kind of look at that data and figure out why this happened. You know, was there more people flying out? Then you can bring in factors. Was it because of COVID? People weren't flying as much, so now we're seeing more flights out. Did they get bigger airplanes? And I have to kind of turn that into a narrative that, you know, ultimately is a positive win for the city, because the city is growing the airport. So I have to see, like, okay, there's less flights, but there's more seats available and more people are flying out. And I'll take that, they're raw numbers that I'm not getting, you know, and then I have to come up with a narrative for it.